know the number one radio station in Bristol and its own class. This is where you need to be. Ujima 98 FM. Pop! Pop!
Here are the ingredients a little new school.
Oh, na, na. What's the name?
A little.
Everybody say. Oh,
yo. Some soul. A little R&B.
They know.
And a taste of old school.
Tell your brother, your sister, and your mama too.
It's a pleasure when you treasure all that's new and true and gay.
The heart of Bristol.
Keep on moving.
You're listening to Ujima 98 FM.
Hello everyone, it's Wednesday, it's Women's Outlook, and this is Cheryl Morgan with another Talking Books segment. I'm delighted to say that we have back in the studio with us today Stephanie Salter. You may have remembered her. She was here a few months ago when her book Gem Signs was just about to be published, and she's had a lot of excitement since then, going to various events promoting the book, including going back home to Jamaica to launch the book there. So that's the sort of thing that we're going to be talking about. I do have just one shout out for you before we can get on with that. As some of you may know, I live in Trowbridge rather than in Bristol, and we have a market every Wednesday, which I walk through on my way to the station when I'm coming in for the show. And today there was a gorgeous smell of jerk chicken wafting through the town centre. So I immediately went to have a look, and I discovered that we now have a Jamaican restaurant in Trowbridge. It's Miss Ellie's Soul Food, and it's at 13 Roundstone Street. And I will definitely be checking that out, because I'm very fond of a good piece of jerk chicken, and indeed many other Caribbean foods as well. Anyway, to get back to the subject of our first half hour, we have Stephanie Salter with us. Just a quick reminder for you, her book Gem Signs is a science fiction novel which talks about genetic engineering, about making people who are different from ordinary humans, might have special powers of some sort. And that looks partly at the very real possibility that we may be able to do that in the near future, but also uses the idea of genetically modified humans to examine the question of what it means to be human, that, you know, how different do you have to be in order to be still counted as a human being. So it's a very, very interesting book, still available in the shops if you want to go out and buy it. But what I'm going to do today is talk to Stephanie about the experience of launching the book, and in particular, going back to Jamaica. It was a pretty big thing over there, wasn't it, Stephanie?
It was. Thanks for having me back, Cheryl. It was amazing. I mean, as you say, there's been a lot of excitement around the book and in my life in general since I was last here. We launched it at a big science fiction convention over Easter. There was a launch in London and there was a launch in Jamaica. And they were all wonderful in their own ways, but what was quite distinctive was the level of attention, not just within the book-loving community or regionally, but actually nationally, that I got in Jamaica. So it was interesting. There was a dual response. There was a huge sense that it was a very big occasion there, that a debut novelist with an international publishing deal for a series, a trilogy, not just the one book. I was invited on to Jamaica's biggest morning television sort of magazine show, the Jamaican equivalent to something like BBC Breakfast or the ITV morning show. I had a write-up in the local newspapers. There was a massive launch to which lots of people came and sort of sat outside and listened to me read and wouldn't let me stop, which was very flattering. And a lot of attention from bloggers and the press. And of course, you know, a debut novelist in the much larger market of the UK simply does not get that kind of attention. So that was absolutely wonderful. But slightly on the flip side of that, there was also a certain degree of bemusement that my chosen area of literature is science fiction. It is speculative fiction. It's quite highly technical and quite complex in terms of what I'm looking at.
Yeah, it's that's definitely something that I was going to ask you about. But first, we should probably just explain a little bit more about the things you did. So you were in a newspaper called The Daily Gleaner?
The Daily Gleaner, which is, when I was growing up, The Daily Gleaner was the paper of Jamaica. It's happily no longer the only one, but it is sort of, you know, the most venerable of our daily newspapers. And the press release was basically reproduced there in its entirety. So there's a wonderful write-up there. One of the interviews that I had just the day of the launch, if I remember right, was a Gleaner journalist who also does an independent blog and magazine, who did quite an extensive telephone interview with me as well as the TVJ appearance and a write-up in the Jamaica Observer, which is the other major daily broadsheet in Jamaica.
Marvelous. And the book launch was at somewhere called Bookophilia. Is that a bookstore?
It's a bookstore, and it's I was delighted beyond expression at the existence of Bookophilia. It's only been there for a few years, so you know I've been gone from Jamaica for a long time since then, and Jamaica does not have much of a book reading and literary culture. Sadly, most of the people who buy books for pleasure also intersect with the ones who travel a lot and therefore can get their books from abroad. And when I was growing up, most of the bookstores in Jamaica were mainly focused on the books you needed for school. So lots of textbooks and academic material with very limited fiction sections. Bookophilia is much more in keeping with what in the UK or the US we'd think of as a bookstore, run by people who are clearly devoted book lovers, and very much in keeping with what we see in independent bookstores here. They've got a cafe in the shop, they've got a children's corner, it's very much a community hub, and they are very, very enthusiastic about books, which is wonderful to see.
Marvellous. I'm delighted that good bookstores are spreading around the world, because we see far too many of them closing these days. And new ones opening is a good thing. Now, to get back to the interview, you were on TVJ, TV Jamaica,
yeah,
on their breakfast show. And you were saying that they were confused as to why you wanted to write science fiction. So what did you tell them?
Well, it was a short slot. And the question was, why did you want to write this book? And the only answer I could come up with then was, you know, there wasn't any other book I wanted to write, which is my default answer. But I think the question came up there, but also in virtually every other interview and conversation I had. And there's just a certain amount of bemusement about why I would consider that to be a legitimate or an appropriate or a desirable field to explore. There seems to be a sort of reflexive assumption that if you're from the Caribbean or if you're from any sort of, you know, underdeveloped or more marginalized community, your interests and your settings would be there. And the example I put to people is, well, why would that be? If someone's from New York or London, the expectation never is that their interests will be confined or their settings will be confined to New York or London. So why would it be any different for me? And it was, you put it in those terms and people go, well, of course you shouldn't be limited in that way. How great that you're not. But it's interesting that until you get to that point in the conversation, the expectation is that you will be writing about what it's like to grow up in the Jamaican countryside, not what it might be like to live at a point of huge cultural upheaval 150 years in the future in a London that has been altered by biotechnology.
There's a new account on Twitter called Writers of Colour, which is quite interesting. They're mainly there trying to get more people of colour into the UK newspapers and television and whatever. But they've been having one or two interesting discussions. There was an article this morning by Nikesh Shukla, who lives in Bristol. Hello, Nikesh. And he was talking about movies, that if you've got a movie that comes out of Hollywood or out of Britain, you very rarely see brown people in it, unless they're there either as a token or they're there to talk about something to do with race.
Yes. Yes, I agree. It's absolutely right. And I know we're going to talk a bit about what I've been doing more recently at the Nine Worlds Convention. And that is a topic that has been covered very extensively there as well, that expectation that there are sort of roles that one is expected to to play. And I think it's certainly true, just as true in film as it is in literature, and in some ways even more visible. I actually read a fabulous blog post from a Scottish writer named Hal Duncan last night, in which he talks about marginalisation and segregation in literature, and he lists, I think was it the top 20 or top 50 Hollywood movies of the last several years, I think 2011, and notes that none of them have a lead character of colour, and most of them don't have any characters of colour unless they are there to serve one of the roles you've just described, which is absolutely shameful.
Okay, well, we'll come on and talk a little bit about this convention that you were at in London over the weekend in a little while, but it's now coming up to time for the ads. So, Mark, if we could please.
Come on, let's get the CD and the radio to play our show again. It's about time we got some airplay of our version of events.
Tune in to Ujima 98 FM for Paulette North's Outlook Show from 12 to 2 on Thursdays, the show that peels back the layers and analyses community issues to seek out all truth. These are the issues that you care about. It's raw, real, and refreshing.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
This is Johnny Bling from Dancehall Generals.
I am Miss P alongside
Deeper from the Ninja Mix crew.
On Thursday, 15th of August,
we will be taking part in the next Rumble.
On the radio.
To see who will be victorious in the next encounter.
Music categories: dancehall, hip hop,
soccer,
R&B,
Afrobeats.
Doors open 9:30 till late. Admission is free.
So come out and support your team. Niger Crew versus
Dancehall Generals
at the Bank 84 Stokescroft.
Who will be victorious?
You decide.
On Thursday, 15th of August.
And welcome back, everybody. A brief shout out now for anybody. If you've got immigration problems, our free immigration help service is going to be running here at the Ujima Studios in Wilder Street from 3:30 to 5 o'clock this afternoon. So anybody who wants any immigration problems, you can come and talk to somebody from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the Ujima Studios in Wilder Street this afternoon. Please do come in. Now, back to Stephanie Salter. And as we were saying before the ad break, Stephanie spent the weekend at a new science fiction convention that took place near Heathrow Airport. And one of the thrusts of that convention was to increase the level of diversity in the conversation about science fiction and fantasy literature. Stephanie, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be there?
The headline is that it was wonderful, and I will try not to ramble on because one could talk for hours about the Nine Worlds convention. The Nine Worlds Geek Fest, they build it as not just for science fiction and fantasy, not just about literature and film, although those were very well covered, but in fact, as an incredibly broad church for people who from all aspects and spheres of geek fandom. So the first thing I saw walking into the convention on Friday afternoon was Gandalf striding across the car park in the company of an elf with a longbow. And it just got better and better from there. It was absolutely wonderful. But it is, It was conceived and started as a Kickstarter, a crowdfunded enterprise, which I was happy to be one of the early supporters of at the beginning of the year, and had it as its stated aim from the get-go that they wanted to be incredibly inclusive and to talk about issues which have not always been addressed and certainly not always incorporated at the heart of fan conventions traditionally. And that's around gender equality, around racial diversity, around access for people of any and all abilities, and not just access into the physicality of the convention itself, but talking about representation and access within film, within literature, within all of these spheres of fandom. There was a massive and very welcome discussion about issues to do, as I said, with gender and sexuality, both touching on what we've been seeing in the media recently with the harassment that's taken place and the intolerance of people of difference, primarily feminist spokespeople, I suppose you could say, but also representations around sexuality as well. And it was, and they lived up to it, I have to say. I thought it was worth supporting because of its aims. I wasn't certain they could actually pull it off, and I'm happy to report that they did. I have never been to anything that I think was so gloriously, proudly diverse and inclusive as the Nine Worlds Convention.
Hmm. I understand you ran a writing workshop with Roshita Loyenries.
Yes, it was the final thing that I did at the end of this long weekend, and it capped off all of those issues. Rachita and the person running the queer track, Tori Trislow, had come up with the idea of doing a shortened version of a workshop called Writing the Other, which was originally conceived by the American writers Niecy Shawl and Cynthia Ward. And it's all about learning to spot the unconscious biases that we bring to what we read. So the perception that, unless specifically described otherwise, you are reading about white, straight males who have a certain income and educational level, who sort of fit the dominant patriarchies of the United Kingdom, Europe, and the United States. And that very often, when you have the description of someone as being of a different race or ethnicity, of a being a female gender or having an alternate sexuality or something else that doesn't fit into that dominant paradigm, they are simply there as a token, or they are there to provide a purpose for the main character, as opposed to having their own agency and their own sense of validity within the story.
Well, that sounds great. I would actually have loved to have been involved in that, but sadly I couldn't make it down to London over the weekend.
I suspect it may happen again, so next time.
That will be good, yes. Now, let's come back to Jamaica now, because I know a lot of our listeners have family in Jamaica. Mm. And you were there recently. How are things? How is Jamaica coping with the recession?
Probably not well. I suspect there are places that have it even worse off, but it has definitely hit the country very, very hard. And it's quite evident. I think it's Jamaica's always been one of those places where the distinction between different levels of society, between rich and poor, is very stark. I think one of the things I noticed on this last trip is that it's become even more stark with the recession. There's certainly the economy is so dependent on tourism that, you know, tightened wallets in other parts of the world have a very profound effect on what happens in Jamaica. So the fact that people are just making a lot less money is something that was quite evident. But at the same time, especially in Kingston, in the more affluent areas, there's not the sense that all that much has changed for them. And I think it's kind of a repeated pattern, isn't it? We see it here in the UK as well.
Yeah. I had a quick look at the Jamaican newspapers last night to see if I could find out what the big political issues were. And in fact, the front pages were just covered with reports from Moscow, from the World Athletics Championships.
Well, athletics is always a big story in Jamaica. It's certainly, I don't know how much it does for the country economically, but it's certainly a huge point of pride that that Jamaican athletes, sprint athletes particular, Usain Bolt obviously being the headline act there, do so well. So it's a massive point of national pride. Having said that, and I have to say I'm not a sports nut, so I haven't followed this story possibly as closely as I could, but there had been a couple of instances recently where some Jamaican athletes had failed drugs tests, and that's caused a huge sort of outcry and sense of embarrassment in the country as well. But it's certainly one of the things that makes people feel good about themselves and their nation, the success at the Olympics and in athletics generally.
I should mention as well, of course, that the Caribbean Premier League T20 competition is taking place at the moment. I know you're not a sports nut.
It's terrible that I didn't
but,
know
you
that.
Know, it's an opportunity for me to mention cricket, Sorrel. And Jamaica is actually doing pretty well. And now I know what a talawa is, because I had to look that up. Alrighty. So, yes, Okay, back down to earth now. We've had a lot of talk in the UK with regarding things going on in Moscow with the new laws that the Russians are bringing in to make it illegal to talk publicly about being gay and so on. So here there's been a lot of talk about wanting to boycott the Olympics. Stephen Fry has written to the Prime Minister and so on. I gather that's not quite the same issue in Jamaica. In fact, being gay is still illegal over there.
It's still illegal. I mean, it's the 150-year-old anti-sodomy laws, which have been abolished, long since abolished in this and in most other developed countries, are still very much alive in Jamaica. And there is massive homophobia and massive discrimination against and a lack of comprehension of people of anything other than heteronormative sexuality in Jamaica. I'm personally appalled by the laws that have been put in place in Russia. I'll be boycotting the Olympics in my old small way by simply not watching them. And it's part of why I've not been up to date on what's been happening in the athletics in Moscow at the moment, because I'm just too appalled to tune into anything happening in Moscow. But I think that will not have any impact at all, sadly, in Jamaica, because they are where this country probably was 50 or 60 years ago in terms of thinking about issues of equality around sexuality, around issues of gender and alternate genders. I think the vast majority of Jamaicans would be perplexed at the suggestion that there was anything absolutely fine and normal about homosexuality, or that there was any way of understanding gender except as the binary. Anatomically male is male, anatomically female is female, and there's absolutely no crossover. It's not just being aware of the issue and disagreeing with it, it's a complete lack of awareness.
And this rather concerns me, because Jamaica is part of the world that I would very much like to visit. You know, I love cricket, I love the food, I love the people and so on. But there was an incident about last month, I think about 22nd of July, where a 16-year-old Jamaican person by the name of Dwayne Jones was brutally murdered by a mob at a party because they discovered that what they thought was a 16-year-old girl was actually a 16-year-old trans person. And was still partly anatomically male. I gather that the Justice Minister, Mark Goldberg, has spoken out against this and condemned the killing, but so far the police have had no luck tracking down the people responsible. And what really horrified me about the story was that Dwayne was living in a shared house with some other trans people because she, I'm going to use she because I assume that that's the pronoun she'd prefer, had been kicked out of home by her family when she was 14. And after the murder, the family refused to accept the body back, saying that it was, this person was nothing to do with them anymore.
I read that report. I'm horrified and heartbroken by it, but I can't say that I'm terribly surprised. As I said, there is very little understanding or awareness, let alone sympathy or compassion for any sense of what, I think we wouldn't even use the term alternate sexuality here anymore, but it's probably still applicable there. I think, again, this comes back to something I mentioned earlier about, you know, the differences in class and socioeconomics. Jamaica's pretty homophobic and intolerant at all levels of society, but of course the more educated and affluent you are, the more the responses are different. I think if Dwayne Jones had been the child of wealthier, more educated parents, she, and I will use your pronoun because I certainly, you know, don't know what she would have preferred, but we'll assume that would have been it. I'd like to think she would have been accepted as a trans person. There's a chance, there's probably a better chance she would have been sent to psychiatrists to fix the problem. But living in a more affluent, upscale, middle-class neighborhood, she probably wouldn't have been thrown out of the family and ended up being beaten to death. It would have been a less brutal, but I think no less complete form of intolerance that would have been experienced.
Paulette, you've been nodding along there. You got anything to add?
Well, slightly disagree with you that I think that even if she came, and I agree with your analysis that if you are more affluent, you've had more education, possibly, and you know you're wider, you have wider views. But I, having lived and worked in Jamaica for 2 years in 1986 and returned many times, I think that it's there. The homophobia is there within every strata of society, no matter what class you come from. And I think that it's a lot to do with the church, because the church over there has that such a grip on what people think and feel. They have a lot to do with the education over there. I worked at Calabar High School, which was a Baptist-run church. And it go on every street corner. They say in England there's a pub, in every street corner in Jamaica there's a church. And I think that the church has such a lot to answer for, as well as the education system. When I was teaching there and tried to bring up these issues, because over in England we were talking about it, and we had moved on only a little bit, but we had moved on in terms of, you know, educating around homophobic issues. It just didn't seem to have any grip at all. So I'm not surprised about what had happened, but it is...
I agree with you. I think, I think the only difference is that the reaction would not have been as brutal, but I don't think it would have been any more tolerant. And I do agree with you that there is a very strong religious element to that. It's the excuse. I don't know that that it is a church-going country in the traditional sense, but it's certainly what people refer to biblical phrases as justification constantly.
Absolutely.
Well, sorry to have to end on a bit of a down note, folks, but we will be talking to Stephanie again later in the show. Now, however, it's time for the news.
Keeping Bristol informed. Ujima News, brought to you by BBC Radio Bristol.
The Conservatives and Liberal Democrats have decided to give their share of £500,000 bequest from a Bristol woman to the Treasury after a row about how she'd intended the money to be spent. Joan Edwards, a former nurse who died last September at the age of 90, left the money in her will to whichever government is in office at the date of my death, but her executors shared it between the two political parties. Patrick O'Neill is from a will-writing service in Bristol. He says it's vital to make the wording specific.
I've been asked to draft the provisions. I'd first of all be asking the individual more detailed questions as to exactly what their intentions were and what they wanted the money used for. Essentially, if it's to be used for the general public goods by way of bolstering taxes, then it should be gifted to the Crown.
Unemployment fell by 4,000 between April and June. It stands at just over 2.5 million. The number of people claiming Job Seekers Allowance fell last month to its lowest level for more than 4 years. David Freeman is from the Office for National Statistics and explains the figures.
Unemployment remains fairly flat, and in the 3 months to June, the number of people unemployed fell by just 4,000 to stay at 2.51 million. And the unemployment rate was also stable at 7.8%. We're also releasing the claimant counts, the number of Job Seekers Allowance claimants in July, and they fell by just over 29,000 to 1.4 million claimants. And that's the lowest number of claimants we've seen since the beginning of 2009.
A Bristol sports coach says police failed to properly investigate serious abuse about him, which appeared on a social media site. James says someone set up a Facebook page accusing him of being a child abuser, but that person hasn't been caught. Avon and Somerset police say they take reports of anyone sending malicious communications very seriously. Last year, 20 people from this region were prosecuted. Dr. Claire Hardacre is a linguistics lecturer who studied so-called trolling. She says it's not only police who need to take an interest.
We are very behindhand, I have to say. When it comes to dealing with it, I think we have a lot of things that we need to be doing. For kids right from school, I think we need to be training them on how to be safe online from trolls, but also how to be kind to each other, because some of these children, sadly, will be the bullies of the future. I think we need to be training parents on the signs to recognise. I think we also need to be getting on the police's case a little bit and saying, take this stuff seriously.
The Olympic champion Greg Rutherford is out of the World Athletics Championships after failing to qualify for the long jump final. He was unable to reach the qualifying distance with any of his three jumps. From Moscow, here's the BBC's Mike Costello.
He missed out by just 2 centimetres. Such are the margins between success and failure at this level of international athletics. Rutherford's best effort was 7 metres, 87 centimetres, almost half a metre adrift of his gold medal winning distance at London 2012. It was good enough only for 14th place, with the top 12 qualifying for the final. A hamstring injury suffered 5 weeks ago had threatened his participation, and he came here with hope more than conviction that he could rediscover his best form. There will be questions now as to whether British athletics should have selected an athlete in such circumstances. But for Rutherford himself, the gaze will turn now to a busy 2014 with the World Indoor Championships, the Commonwealth Games and the European Championships.
And in football, the England manager Roy Hodgson says the friendly with Scotland tonight will act as useful preparation ahead of the remaining World Cup qualifiers. The match is the first meeting between the two countries in 14 years.
Ujima News, brought to you by BBC Radio Bristol.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Women's Outlook. I'm Cheryl Morgan, and in the next half hour, we're going to be talking about rowing across the Atlantic. Now, regular listeners may remember that we've had Hannah and Jess in the studio before telling us about the project that they've got going on. We've got Hannah here to give us an update on things. Hannah, where's Jess? Is she okay?
She's absolutely fine. Yeah, she's at work.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, yeah, work is kind of important and stuff. But I guess we should probably start by reminding everybody why you are doing this, because people just don't decide to row across the Atlantic in the middle of winter, do they?
They certainly don't. We lost an inspirational friend last year to cervical cancer. Elle was 23 when she passed away. So it was kind of a bit of an inspiration for us to go out there and do something that was quite a big adventure and was going to test us. So we signed up and off we went.
And it's not just you doing it. It's some sort of competition that's going on.
That's right, yeah. It's a race. It's organised by Atlantic Campaigns and it's sponsored by Talisker Whiskey. And it's an organised race that was based on the first crossing in 1966 by Shea Blythe. And we go across doing exactly the same route, pretty much, from La Gomera over to Antigua.
Right. And the first thing that occurs to me, of course, is do you get any free bottles of Talisker? Because I'm rather fond of it.
We certainly do. We'll have to
Excellent.
Bring some down.
Yeah, well, it'll help keep you warm on the way across. Don't drink too much, though. You might lose
Christmas
your
Day.
Way. So it's a celebration, say, of the first crossing. Is that why you're doing it in December?
It's purely because of the weather. So it's out of hurricane season and there's less storms during that time. So you wouldn't really want to be going before kind of mid-November, really, and then up to kind of March kind of time is the best time to cross, really.
Okay, so that was one thing that was, because weather in Britain in December is pretty horrible. I think, why are they going in December? Why not go in the summer when it's warm? But yes, hurricanes.
Yeah, we're quite lucky. It should be relatively warm because we start from La Gomera and then we drop south and then we go across just north of the equator. So it should be about between 28 and 32 degrees most of the time during the day.
Right.
I say during the day, it's 12 hours daylight, 12 hours night when we're out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's not actually much daylight.
Yeah, but I mean, 28 to 30, that's actually quite warm. Mm. I mean, we had a little hot spell here in Britain a few weeks back and everybody was complaining bitterly because temperatures were over 20. So 28 to 30, you're going to feel it.
Mm, definitely. It's quite important, obviously, for our skin to have the right sun protection as well. And it's getting like we went out in the boat during the heat wave, actually. And well, it was good because it was a good experience going out in the heat. But yeah, it's hard work. Very hard work.
I heard a rumour from Paulette that you're going to row naked.
That rumour's true.
Why?
Purely down to chafage more than anything. Obviously, salt water, once it dries, it becomes very abrasive and it's like sandpaper. So anything that you wear is going to just literally cut into your skin constantly because we're doing it, obviously, repetitive movement. So the only way to help aid that is to row naked.
Well, presumably you're going to get an all-over tan. There'll be no problem with like stripes like I've got. Yeah, well, that should leave you looking very good and perfectly positioned for the beach next summer.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. So how are things going? How's the training?
Yeah, good. Training's going well. Still quite intense, but we're still doing the same kind of training routine, really. So we've got three sessions of weights a week, and then the days that we aren't doing weights, we've got ergo work and then getting onto the boat. So it's still quite a lot to be doing.
And is there some sort of target that you're setting and working towards?
Not really. There's no research done on ocean rowing, so our strength and conditioning guy has been looking into endurance events like Marathon du Sable, Polar Explorers and things like that to try and work out what training they did. But there isn't really an aim at the end of the training. We just need to be as fit and as strong as possible so that we can go out there and try and break this record.
There was a very interesting Horizon programme on BBC Two on Monday talking about medical monitoring systems, and they were looking at sports teams. I think it was the English rugby sevens, where they're monitoring them all the time just to keep an eye on their state of health, and they reckon that they can spot injuries almost before they happen and get people off the pitch to stop it going really bad. Is there anything like that you'll be having so people can monitor your health while you're out at sea?
Not really. We're pretty much on our own once we're out there, to be honest. And we've been trained up to know how to deal with different situations, and we can also ask for medical advice when we're out there. We won't get disqualified for that. It's not seen as having any help. So we can certainly contact people, but things are going to happen no matter what. It's such a monotonous thing that we're doing that something's going to go at some point.
Yeah. So part of the rules is that you're not allowed to have any aid at all.
Yeah, that's right. Everything has to be on board the boat when we leave on the race start. If we take any help while we're out there, we'll get disqualified, basically. So all equipment, spares have to be with us.
Right.
All our food.
Now, that help means no help from other people, but presumably you can take stuff on the boat. So you've got electronic equipment for navigation definitely. And the like?
Yeah, we certainly have. We're pretty much up to scratch as a yacht that would be going across, really, with all our comms on board. The only issue that we've got is that if we capsize or any water gets into those, obviously they're going to get damaged and they won't work. And I was just saying that I've just bought the charts for us going across as well, so we'll be plotting our way across so we can kind of see where we are if all those do kind of break on us or whatever. So,
and you have a GPS system to keep you navigating straight?
Yeah, that's right. We've got kind of a car sat nav inside the boat, which is fixed, right. And then we'll take some handhelds with us as well.
Yeah, so it's not like you have to take positions of the stars every night. Or
we did that on a course. We'd be rubbish at that. We'd probably end up somewhere else.
Dear, I mean, now I've seen on old ships where they have the navigator's table and things, but if you're rowing, you've got nowhere to work.
Charts are quite expensive, and I've just bought them, and we're literally going to cut them all up into little bits, the parts that we need, and then take them with us, so... we haven't got that much room at all. I mean, our boat's only 7 meters by 1.9 inside the cabin. It's about just over 2 meters, and a lot less in width. So it's quite a small space to be in. Lots to be rocking around quite a lot.
Yeah. Talking of cabins, what do you do at night? Does one person sleep while the other person keeps rowing, or?
So it's just a continuous shift pattern. So it's 2 hours on, 2 hours off continuously while we're out there, during the night and during the day. So you just literally just keep on going and going on your shift and rest up if a storm comes, I guess, and you can't row anymore. But apart from that.
Okay, so to come back to the electronics, can you keep in touch with home? Are you going to have like mobile phones or something like that?
Yeah, we can keep in touch. We've got a sat phone, which means that we can email, we can call, and we can send videos back. It's quite an expensive process to do, but we can do that. So we'll be hopefully keeping a written blog that we can send back. We'll probably try and do a video once or twice in every 2 to 3 weeks, and then we've got voice blogs that we can do as well, so hopefully we can do those a little bit more often. Keep you updated.
What about Twitter? That's only 140 characters.
Very true. I think we'll have to send that in an email back to one of our land team. They'll have to tweet it, reduce it down and tweet it.
Well, you know, if you can tweet, I'm sure we'll be following you, and we'd be wanting to tell all of our listeners what you're getting
we'll
up to
there.
while you're out there. Now, the other important part of the trip, of course, is money. So how are we doing in terms of getting sponsors?
Well, in total, we aim in for about £100,000 to actually go out there and compete. We've currently got £70,000, so we're about £30,000 short at the moment. We've set up a 100 club for businesses around the UK and local businesses, which is basically where there's 100 tickets for sale. Each ticket's £500 each. and they'll all go into a prize draw, and the winner will be picked out and they'll become one of our main sponsors, which is worth £50,000, because that's what our current main sponsor put in the pot. So it's worth £50,000 to somebody. So that's kind of our initiative at the moment, to try and get the rest of the money in if we can.
Alrighty, so businesses out there in Bristol, if you've got £500 to spare, you can certainly support the rowing effort. And also, of course, you've got a chance of getting some really, really good publicity out of this. Is there a website that people should go to if they're interested in sponsoring you?
Yeah, certainly. They can go on to insfriends.org.uk.
Alrighty. And what about ordinary people like me? I mean, yeah, I'd love to sponsor you, but £500 is quite big out of my business's budget.
Sure. Well, if you go onto our website, there is an option on there to either give money to the charities that we're raising money for, or there's an option to sponsor us, and you can sponsor us any amount that you want to from that. So if you want to just put in a couple of pounds, or you want to put in £5, you can do that on our website as well.
Alrighty. Well, that certainly sounds like something I hope lots of people will be doing. We're going to talk to Hannah a little bit more later in the programme, but right now, it's time for the ads.
Let's
tell you about a gig. Harvey's Wine Bar, Wine Cellars in Denmark Street, Bristol. This, of course, silly on me. And 8 till 8, we'd love you all to come down and join us. We have a fantastic live band.
Anyway, so John and Richard, we appear live, but it's the Harvey's Bristol Blues, first Tuesday of every month at Harvey's Cellars, 12 Denmark Street, Bristol. But we'd love to see you there. In the meantime, here is...
The Avon and Bristol Law Centre, in partnership with Ujima Radio 98 FM, are holding immigration drop-in sessions at Ujima 97 to 107 Wilder Street. These are free sessions, so if you have any immigration queries, come on down to the station on Wednesday the 14th of August, Wednesday the 21st of August, or Wednesday the 28th of August, between 1 and 5pm. Indrani Curry will be here to give free advice.
The Starlight Weekender. The Starlight Weekender. The Alton Towers Hotel and Spa Special. The 22nd to 24th of November. 3 days, 2 nights, 2 arenas. The best DJs. A live real deal comedy jam. And access to Alton Towers rides, water park and spa with 20% off all treatments. Arena 1, the best deep sexy soulful house. Old school garage and old school niche. Mark Bradford, Conti and Bushkin, Carlos Aries, Jamie Duggan and many more. Arena 2, the best bashment R&B, hip hop and soul. V-Rocket, Killer Filler, Hurricane Jermaine, KD Infinity and more. Early bird tickets, an amazing £90, including hotel accommodation based on 3 people sharing. First come, first serve. Book now. 0844 870 0000, or visit starlightmusicevent.com.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Women's Outlook. I'm Cheryl Morgan, and I'm talking to Hannah here from the team of two young ladies from Bristol who are going to be rowing across the Atlantic in December to raise money for a cervical cancer charity. We were talking while the ads were on about safety. I mean, clearly, you know, you're out there in a rowing boat in the middle of the Atlantic. That's not terribly safe, but hopefully there are things that you can do, like to prevent people from being swept overboard. What sort of equipment do you have?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're going to have a two safety system. So if it's relatively calm, we don't really need to attach ourselves to the boat. If it's getting a bit choppy, then we're looking at like just a surf leash that we can attach ourselves to the boat with, so that we're still attached if the boat does flip. If it's really rough weather, the chances are we won't be rowing in it, but if we need to go on deck, then we've got the option of a life jacket and a safety line that attaches us to the boat. So we've got, as long as we're in the right frame of mind and remember to implement those safety, they should be absolutely fine. Should be okay.
And presumably you've got some sort of electronic signal, and you've got flares. And
yeah, we have. Yeah, our equipment list is quite comprehensive, with pretty much anything you could possibly think of. So we've got loads of different flares that we have to take out with us. We've got a couple of different electronic devices that we can set off if we are in distress. So we should be picked up if there's a problem.
Now, I understand you've got the boat now, and you're going to take it out to sea for some trials. When would that be?
Yeah, we're going out on the 14th and 15th of September. It's an organised sea trial event for some of the Atlantic rowers. We'll go out down in Christchurch in Dorset. We go out there for 24 hours, basically, and try and use every single bit of equipment that we've got on board, make sure we know how to use it, and we'll be tested on our competency when we go out.
All right, so that's something that the competition is running, to make sure that all of the contestants are competent to take part.
That's right, yeah. We have to You have to, before you can even go to the start line, you have to have done these 24 hours, just so that they can see that you've actually gone out in the boat and you're not just turning up and going to give it a whirl, basically.
And we've got Jackie in the studio with us. Jackie had one or two questions that she wanted to ask. So, Jackie, fire away.
One of the questions I wanted to ask was, all of these boats have usually got names. So I wondered, how did you come by your boat's name and what is it?
So our boat name, it took quite a while to decide, actually, because I was being quite fussy on it. I wanted it to be the right name and I wanted it to have the right meaning behind it. And we were down on our courses down in Tynmouth when we came up with it. And I came up with the name Diligence. And it, for some reason in my head, it just came about that a lot of boats are named Diligence. So I scrapped the idea, went on to a Thesaurus online and came up with the name Sedulous. So we call it a sedulous, and it means diligent and studious and perseverance. So all the things that we kind of aspire into for the row, and also all the attributes that Elle had that we're doing it in memory of. So that's how we came about the name.
Oh, and how do you prepare psychologically for this kind of journey? Will you be talking to each other when you're rowing, or... or is it going to be in silence? Is there going to be music? What's going to be?
We're having some like sports psychology meetings at the moment about when we're going to be out there. But to be honest, everybody that we've spoken to, they've just said that in a pair, generally your shift pattern, you're doing a shift pattern. So the only time you really see each other is when you're changing your shift. And you might say a couple of words to each other, but most important thing is eating and sleeping for the person that's just put the oars down. So you're pretty much just listening to music and audio books, or, you know, just going along and watching what's going on. I'm not going to lie, it's going to be one of the most most boring experiences ever. And I think that's one of the things that we've got to deal with, of how when you're really bored, what you start to think about. Obviously with sleep deprivation as well, you start to hallucinate. So that's something else that we need to factor in.
So the sleeping element, you only have 2 hours on and 2 hours off, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
So you're supposed to get your sleep in the 2 hours that you get off. Yeah, how possible is that? Can you practice that before you go?
Not really. It's one of those things you just have to get on with, because if you practiced it, you'd be tired before you went out. We did a practice 24-hour row in an ergo, in a chamber on an ergo, on a row machine. And to be honest, in those 2 hours off, by the time you'd had food, you'd strapped your hands, you strapped your feet up, you probably had about 40 to 50 minutes sleep. So it's not very much, but you kind of get into it. Your body gets into a routine with it. So although you're going to be tired, you'll get into a routine and you'll just keep on pushing through it.
And how do you manage in the pitch black night with no lights?
Good question. We're going to be sat on a bearing, in effect. Now, the compass illuminates at night, so we can still see the compass, and we should know what kind of bearing we're aiming towards anyway. So it's just a matter of just keep on rowing and keep on rowing and look out for lights and the distance of ships that are potentially coming towards you.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
So you're starting out in December. How long is it going to take you to get to Antigua?
Well, average crossing is 75 days, so 2 to 3 months. We're aiming to beat the GB women's pairs record, which currently stands at about 75 days. So we're going to aim between 60 and 65.
So that means you'll be away over Christmas.
We will be indeed.
Do you have any special plans? You're going to take something with you for Christmas dinner?
Not as yet. We haven't got any special plans. I'm sure we'll take something to kind of raise morale a little bit on board for Christmas Day and New Year's Eve as well, obviously. But no special plans as yet as what we're going to do on Christmas Day. Keep rowing, I presume.
Well, you've got to do that every day, I guess. What about the other teams? Have you met any of those at all?
Yeah, I've met quite a few of them now. To be honest, everyone is so nice that's doing it, and everyone's in the same situation at the moment, you know, trying to get the last few sponsors in to get the last bits of money in, and so they can get their equipment and just getting out on the boat, because all the boats are shipped out early October. So we've only got her now for about another 2 months, and then she leaves. So,
And are all of the other competitors raising money for charity?
They are. Yeah, I don't know of a single competitor that isn't. Every competitor's got a charity that's close to their heart and the reason behind why they're doing it. But I think that also helps to raise the profile of the event as well, by them doing it for charity. So,
Absolutely. Yeah. So you mentioned that you're going to have a yacht going along with you with a support team on it. How many people are involved in that?
I think there's about 12 to 15 support crew on there, and they literally just sit at the back of the whole race pack and follow everybody up, and if there's any problems then they're obviously going to be a lot faster than us rowing, so they hopefully can get to us within a few days.
So that's one boat for the entire competition?
Yep.
Right, so it's not like every team has to have...
No, there's just one.
Yeah. So what about your family? Are they're just going to be back home waiting for email? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. We spoke to a gentleman actually a little while ago that's done it 3 times, and he said, "You think you've got it bad, but actually it's harder for the people at home that have no idea what's going on. They can just see this little tracker, and every now and then it might go off and malfunction, and they're wondering what's going on, and they get worried, and you're actually okay, but they don't know that." And it was a fair point to make, to be honest, because I hadn't really thought of it like that. I think keeping in contact with them is going to be a good thing, because although we might find it difficult, it'll probably keep them a little bit happier and a bit more secure in what we're doing. So,
Yeah. So it's all coming up to like time now. How's the confidence doing?
Okay, I mean, there's things that scare me, I'm not going to lie about it. Thinking about some of the things that could happen out there, they are quite scary thoughts. But I think going out there and being able to know the kind of things that are going to happen and be able to expect them and what to do in those situations is going to be quite a big thing for us.
Yeah. So presumably there's a whole bunch of training that you do, say, if this bad thing happens, how do we deal with it?
Yeah, we've had to do 4... RYA courses, which are the Royal Yacht Association courses, which included all of our navigation and our sea trials and first aid at sea and all of our safety when we're out there.
Yeah, well, it's an awful lot of preparation to do, isn't it? So, you mentioned that Jess was busy working at the moment. You've both taken all of this time off work to do this?
I work for British Rowing and I finish working for them at the end of this month. So I'll be back into not having a job, so can concentrate pretty much on the row itself. But I believe Jessie is getting a sabbatical from work for it.
Right. Yeah. Mark, our techie, is just asking, how much does it cost to do all this preparation?
To enter the race is about £20,000 for a pair. And overall, including all of your equipment and getting the boat, you're looking at about £100,000 in total.
Right, and that's why you need all the sponsorship.
Indeed, yeah, it's quite an expensive trip to go out there and do.
Jackie?
I just want to ask a basic question. What do you eat and how do you prepare your meals while you're away? Because it's obviously important with all that rowing to get some calories in.
It is indeed.
So do you have a nutritionist or anything?
We are working with a nutritionist, but our main meals are going to be freeze-dried food, adventure food, because they're high calorie and they're very light.
So can you explain what that's like? Because
baby food.
Is it?
It's pretty much like baby food. It all looks kind of the same. It's just a big mushy block in effect.
What does it taste like?
The taste isn't so bad, but it's very stodgy and heavy. And I'm sure you can imagine that when it's hot in this country, all you want to do is kind of eat salads and light foods that are quite refreshing. This is like really, really heavy, stodgy food to eat. It tastes all right.
A bit like porridge?
A bit like porridge that hasn't got enough of milk in it. So it's a bit like, it's like a block. it's not too bad. It tastes fine. And to be honest, if you're hungry, you're going to eat it. So
you're taking a fishing line with you just in case?
Probably not. I mean, we could take one just in case, but knowing my luck, we'd probably catch a fish that was poisonous. Sod's law.
I don't know where you get flying fish, but that would be kind of convenient if a shoal of flying fish came past
they
and
do.
One or two land
yeah.
in the boat.
Yeah, they do. We quite a few crews have said that they've seen flying fish and that they've come over the boat and been hit by them and stuff, so interesting.
There you go. I believe that they're edible.
Yeah. Oh, right, brilliant.
You've got to take a huge supply of water.
We've got a water maker on board, so it basically desalinates the seawater. It takes about, for every 50 litres, in an hour it'll go through about 50 litres of salt water and it'll produce about 5 litres of drinkable water.
Excellent.
Yeah, so we've got that. And our ballast is water as well, but we can't really break into that, so we get penalised if we break into that.
But you would in an emergency?
Yeah, we definitely would in an emergency, because that, you know, if our water maker broke and we get dehydrated, then that's one of the worst, that'll kill us, so... definitely break into it.
So the purpose of the ballast is just to keep the boat steady, is it?
Yeah, pretty much, and to make sure that it self-rights. So if it does flip over, then it will self-right itself.
Yeah, because like you really don't want the...
No. Put yeah. upside down isn't much good to
going, going for a swim is not really the right sort of idea.
I think they're very brave, both of them.
Oh, incredibly brave, yes. I mean, I would never have been fit enough to do that sort of thing when I was Panna's age. So what do you think you're getting out of this? Well, I mean, obviously, you're raising money for charity, but you know, you think this is going to change you as a person?
I think it will. Everybody that I've spoken to that's done it, they've all said it's a completely life-changing experience. You come back and you don't want to do the things that you've been doing previously, and you know, nothing like anything that you think about doing, you'll just go and do, because you've done such a big task to start with that just anything else just becomes quite a small thing to go and do. You believe you can just do anything. So yeah, I think it will. I mean, I'm really looking forward to kind of being completely broken down, really, which sounds a bit weird, but most people go through life and never really get to the point where they're at the lowest point, like their truly lowest point, and have to build themselves back up again. And I'm quite excited to do that, because you can only build yourself back up stronger. So that's one of my things I'm looking forward to.
Do you think you'll miss the rowing when it's done, or do you think you'll never want to see a rowboat ever again?
I don't know. Rowing's been in my life for just over 10 years now. So to not want to get in a boat ever again, I think it'd be quite unfortunate. I don't want to come back from it not wanting to get in a boat again. But who knows, it might happen.
Wow. I mean, it certainly is an absolutely amazing thing to do. And part of me is really jealous, because it's like a great adventure and things. Mm. But I know that I'm just not physically up to it, and probably never would be. But, you know, really, the very best of luck to you. And we'll certainly be